From Pacifica Radio, this is Democracy Now!
Okay, at this point in time, you're speaking to Johnny Ponte Landsman. I am a federal detainee. I am holding hostages here in the control booth. Also, in the warden's office, we have other hostages.
Cuban prisoners in the fourth day of a rebellion at a Louisiana jail. We'll hear from the prisoners and their hostages. The latest on little Elian Gonzalez and making a fortune off of misfortune. MCI and AT&T have a special friends and family plan for prisoners. All that and more coming up on Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! Welcome to Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. The Russian military appears to have suffered its worst defeat since moving into Chechnya in September, when Russian tanks and armored personnel carriers rolled into the capital of Grozny yesterday. They were surrounded by hundreds of Chechen fighters firing rocket-propelled grenades. An Associated Press reporter counted 115 dead Russian soldiers lying in the city square where the ambush took place. Many of the bodies were mangled by gunfire and badly burned. Moscow denies a tank assault on Grozny and says only two of its soldiers have been killed during the past 24 hours. Meantime, Russian artillery continues to pound Grozny today. The United Nations and its member states failed Rwanda in deplorable ways in 1994, ignoring evidence that a genocide was planned, refusing to act once it was underway, and finally abandoning the Rwandan people when they most needed protection. This according to an independent report commissioned by Secretary General Kofi Annan, showing a UN peacekeeping mission in Rwanda doomed from the start by an insufficient mandate and later destroyed by the Security Council's refusal to strengthen it once the killings began. And it showed UN officials, Annan and then Secretary General Boutros Boutros-Ghali among them, unable or unwilling to act on information from the field that a massive slaughter was occurring and that they needed to do something to stop it. This news from Grenoble, France. McDonald's and other fast food stores in France have closed their children's playgrounds for now due to safety concerns. A McDonald's spokesperson says the move was taken as a precaution. Police are investigating the company that supplies the playground equipment. It's accused of issuing safety certificates that don't comply with European Union law. It's also suspected of financial misdealings. McDonald's has temporarily shut down 129 of its 780 playgrounds across France. Meanwhile, France will ring in the new year with a shorter work week. The French Parliament has given final approval to legislation for a 35-hour work week. Most people in France now work about 39 hours a week. Businesses with more than 20 people must implement the law in 2000. Smaller companies have until the year 2002. Conservative lawmakers plan to ask that the law be tossed out, but such a ruling would be unlikely before January. Supporters hope the move will help tackle France's high unemployment rate by having companies hire people to do the work of those working fewer hours. And this news from Los Angeles. As authorities sift through 3,000 cases possibly tainted by officers who lied and planted evidence, a lawsuit suggested there are similar problems elsewhere in the Los Angeles Police Department. Jimmy Lee Render filed a federal lawsuit yesterday accusing two former Central Division officers of false arrest and giving false testimony that led to his conviction on drug charges. His conviction was later thrown out after prosecutors failed to challenge accusations of illegal conduct by the officers. Among the cases under review by the Public Defender's Office are more than 800 involving former officer Rafael Perez, who is at the center of the probe. Perez is cooperating in exchange for a lighter sentence on his conviction for stealing cocaine from a police evidence room. This news from Richmond, Virginia. Years after A.H. Robbins Company began making a birth control device that turned out to be defective, a court case involving nearly $3 billion in payments to about 200,000 women is nearing an end. The Dalkon Shield Claimants Trust mailed a final payment of more than $63 million to 53,800 claimants yesterday and announced that it plans to shut down by March 31st, 8 years ahead of schedule. H. Robbins made about 4 million Dalkon Shield intrauterine birth control devices between 71 and 74. Some users said they suffered from infections, infertility, spontaneous abortions, and pelvic inflammation, and some deaths from infections were reported. In 1984, Robbins said it would pay to have the device removed from women still using it. A lawsuit accusing Microsoft Corporation of anti-competitive conduct that increased the price of personal computers was filed in North Carolina, the latest state to see suits brought against the computer giant. The lawsuit was filed Friday on behalf of county resident Daniel Salvatore and thousands of other North Carolina consumers who bought personal computers loaded with Microsoft's 95 and Windows 98 software. Since a federal judge found on November 5th that Microsoft is a monopoly, several such lawsuits have been filed on behalf of computer users claiming that Microsoft overcharged for its Windows software program.
No more, no more, no more auction block for me. Many thousand gone.
Well, Dylan liked that song. He also liked the lady who sang it. And a couple days later, he said...
You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. Cuban detainees who took control of a Louisiana parish jail 4 days ago in a rebellion against their indefinite jailing by the INS yesterday released 26 fellow prisoners from the jail. The detainees, some of whom are thought to have been in INS detention for over 10 years, are demanding safe passage out of the United States. Their situation is similar to many other Cubans in the United States who are convicted of crimes and are placed in deportation proceedings after completing their sentences. Cuba will not take them back, and the INS refuses to release them. So many languish in detention years beyond their original sentences. As many as 9 Cuban detainees at the St. Martin Parish Jail in St. Martinsville in southern Louisiana took over the jail on Monday and are asking to be sent to a third country. They're now in negotiations with the INS and the FBI. We turn now to Joseph Pertiera, a Cuban-American immigration attorney who's based in Washington, D.C., to explain the situation of the detainees before we go to actual tape of the prisoners, the hostages, and why they are currently in the jail. Welcome to Democracy Now!, Jose Pertiera.
Thank you very much.
Can you explain the situation to us?
Well, the situation that is facing many Cuban detainees in United States jails is that they find themselves in a sort of legal limbo. They've completed criminal sentences, and you know the crimes that they committed range anywhere from theft or robbery to even more serious crimes. But they've completed the sentences that the judge has meted out to them. However, because there is no extradition treaty between the United States and Cuba, and there are no relations between the two countries, Cuba refuses to accept the return of these individuals. And the United States government takes the position that they will not release these individuals into society, even though they have completed their criminal sentences. And so they find themselves in a situation where maybe they were given a sentence of a year in jail or even 2 or 5 years in jail, which they've completed, but yet face the prospects of lifetime detention, a life sentence sometimes for crimes that may not be considered serious enough to warrant that kind of a sentence. And so it drives people to desperation because they see no light at the end of the tunnel. They see themselves in jail for the rest of their lives.
Can you talk about how this ties in to the Mariel boatlift and what that was and why the Cuban government won't accept them back?
Well, many years ago when the Mariel boatlift occurred, the Cuban government and the United States government negotiated after a similar uprising in one of the detention facilities in Arkansas. The Cuban and U.S. governments negotiated the return of a certain number of detainees. That number has gone up and down in recent years. It could be, you know, from 1,500 to a little bit more than 2,000 detainees. And Cuba has accepted the return of these individuals. However, that was a very limited number of people. Any Cuban who is not a United States citizen, who is convicted of a crime and faces the possibility of being deported, could potentially end up for the rest of their lives in jail because they are not included in the negotiated list of people returning. Cuba has been steadfast in its refusal to accept the return of deportees unless and until the United States government does away with a law called the Cuban Adjustment Act, which Cuba contends encourages illegal immigration. The Cuban Adjustment Act is a law that passed in 1966 here in the United States, and it basically allows any Cuban who arrives in the United States either with a visa or without a visa to be paroled into the country and a year and a day later apply for and receive permanent residency in the United States. Cuba contends that that is functioning as a magnet for illegal immigration, and they very much want that law done away with. The United States has been unwilling to do away with the Cuban Adjustment Act, and I think as a consequence, Cuba has refused to accept the return of Cuban detainees. And that's the quandary that these people find themselves in U.S. detention facilities.
Jose Portiera is a Cuban-American immigration attorney based in Washington, D.C. We're going to go now to the actual prisoners who are behind the rebellion at the Parrish Jail in Louisiana, and we'll hear from the hostages as well. This is unusual tape, a conversation that took place on WCAC-FM in Baton Rouge in the state capital of Louisiana.
Okay, at this point in time, you're speaking to Johnny Ponte Landsman. I am a federal detainee. I am holding hostages here in the control booth. Also, in the warden's office, we have other hostages.
Okay, now
would you like?
Well, we would just like to talk to you about what is it you're wanting.
Okay, are we live on air?
We are live on the air
right now.
Okay, Mario, put on your radio.
This is CAD Country 103.3 FM in Baton Rouge, Louisiana.
Baton Rouge, Louisiana,
103.3. We are in the state capital.
My claim is we want to be deported to a third country.
You want to go to Cuba?
Cuba doesn't accept us. That's the reason we've been held here years after years after years.
Because Cuba won't accept you?
Why?
Why?
I don't know, ma'am. No diplomatic relationship.
So you're holding hostages there in the St. Martin Parish Jail.
Yes, sir.
And you're holding them in hopes of attaining what?
Exchange for our transfer to another country, our freedom. We've been here in INS custody just because we're Cubans, and our country don't take us back.
Why?
We're doing dead time here in these jails.
Why were you arrested?
Our arrest?
Why were you arrested in the first place to be put in the St. Martin Parish Jail?
No, I wasn't arrested here. I was arrested in the state of Florida. Once I finished my time, INS picked me up. Ever since then, I've been in custody of INS.
In custody of INS?
Yeah,
yes,
why would
Immigration Authorization
here?
Service.
If you were in jail in Florida, how'd you get here?
Yeah, how did you get...
They don't release us because we're Cuban and our government don't accept us back. So we see a panel every year, and they ask us the same question. Do we have a place to live? Do we have a family? Do we have a job waiting for us? We show all that, job recommendation, our family comes to the panels, and they still deny us.
Have you been talking to any negotiators with the authorities?
Yes, sir, we're talking to a lot of the feds, but they're not giving us nothing. So apparently they look like they're not going to give us nothing, you know?
So what is your next step?
Well, sir, we already agreed on that in 72 hours we haven't got an agreement on taking us out of the United States country and sending us to any third country of the world, don't matter where. We'll be happy anywhere we go to be free over there. We just go suicide.
Okay, Gator and JJ on the air live with the hostage takers at the St. Martin Parish Jail. And that you guys are still, now I understand you let an 18-year-old sheriff's deputy go, but you still have the warden and three other deputies. Is that correct?
Yes, sir. On our first agreement, we agreed that if they give me the news channel up here and we go live and everything is on film, whilst releasing them, it's either they're not heard, I will let one go. And I agree that I will let the second one go if they bring me somebody to negotiate, somebody over the INS government, a federal high government. They can tell me yes or no, I'm going to be deported to another country or be immediately released to the custody of my family.
Okay.
Therefore, they have not even told me anything or played any games about it. They just keep giving me the runaround and the runaround. So at this point in time, they're giving us only one solution to look up to.
All right, let me ask you this. Now, you are live on a 100,000-watt FM radio station out of the state capitol in Baton Rouge, Louisiana. The governor is probably listening, as well as legislators. And so be very clear on this. You still have three hostages, is that right?
Yes, sir. We have Deputy Brujo, we have Deputy Sonny, Jolie Sonny, and we have the warden of the jail, Ty Louvier. He is the warden.
Now, let me ask you this.
Ty Louvier is the warden of the jail.
Okay, I'm giving you live airtime to the state capitol, and within a huge radius, I mean, there are a lot of people listening right now. My question to you is, would you be agreeable to letting another hostage go at this time?
No, at this point in time, no one would be released at the jail due to I requested some backup. They did not give it to me. They got sniper targets real close on the windows, no more than 10 feet from us, pointed straight at us in all directions. I request them to back up. They refused to back up. Therefore, they got us under pressure. I've asked for them to back up and to bring us somebody to negotiate. All we want to do is leave the United States country. I repeat, all we want to do is leave.
And if
go any other part of the world. We don't care how they take us there, how they drop us, whether it's in an island deserted, whether it's in a desert. We don't care. We just
want to
leave the uncruishment punishment that we've been receiving in INS custody for all these years,
right,
just because we are Cubans.
Okay.
We have no human right being a Cuban in the United States of America due to INS, Immigration Authorization Service.
Right.
Is one of your hostages a female?
Yes, ma'am.
How are the hostages being treated?
With all respect, nobody's touching the hostages. We have them well comfortable in chairs. We stand up at all times. We requested some soda for them. They did bring us the soda. My deputy here, Brujo, got sick. I requested medication. His medication was brought to him. I gave it to him. Also, I requested for some food for them. Ever since yesterday, since 5 o'clock, they still have not brought food for nobody in the jail at all. Therefore, they're not showing too much care for their deputies, so much less I know they're not going to care about me or whether killing me or my friends.
Let me ask you this. Now, if you're saying that you don't see any signs, that they are meeting your demands? Is that what you said to me?
Yes, sir. They're taking us for a joke.
What do you think? But what are you going to do if this continues then?
Well, we gave them a 72-hour limit.
72 hours?
Yes.
And then what happened?
So when the 72 hours up, they won't give us none of what we're asking for, and we're only asking it under our human rights to be treated like a human. And since we no longer want to be part of the United States of America, to send it to a third country, we're willing to die.
Yeah, I understand.
We know they're going to kill us, so we're going to take the deputies with us, too. We're not dying alone.
Are you threatening? So you're saying that if in 72 hours they have not met your demands, you are going to not only kill the deputies and the warden, but yourself as well?
No, we won't have to kill ourselves. They'll do that on their own. I'm pretty sure they're waiting for the perfect order right now for somebody to say shoot, and they're going to shoot our heads off. They got sniper targets. Like I said, I repeat, they got sniper targets all through the jail surrounding us, all through the roof, all through the hallways, all over. Any move we make away from the deputy where they can get clear shots and not hurt the deputy, we're gone. That's all they're waiting for. Therefore, we hide behind the deputies.
You've been listening to Cat Country 103 in Baton Rouge, the state capital of Louisiana, and the Gator and JJ show. Cuban detainee Johnny Ponte interviewed yesterday about the rebellion that he and others are involved in taking over the St. Martin Parish. When we come back from our break, we'll hear from one of the hostages in that prison, and then we'll speak with other detainees who have recently been released, Cuban detainees from other prisons, and their concerns. After that, we'll talk about little Alien Gonzalez. And then we're going to look at a scam by the state and phone companies like AT&T and MCI, their special friends and family plan for prisoners. You're listening to Pacific Radio's Democracy Now! We'll be back in a minute. You are listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now!, the exception to the rulers. I'm Amy Goodman. As we go back down to Louisiana to the St. Martin Parish Jail in the fourth day of a prisoner rebellion, Cuban detainees have taken over the Louisiana jail to protest their indefinite jailing by the INS. We're now going to hear on this radio interview, it is Cat Country FM in Baton Rouge, an interview with one of the hostages that are being held by the Cuban detainees.
Okay, at this point in time, Mario would like to say a few words to you, if you don't mind.
Okay.
My name is Mario Mora.
Yeah, Mario.
Prisoners in the rebellion.
I'm fine. This is Gator and JJ at Cat Country 103 in Baton Rouge.
All right, great. I hear you got a big audience?
Yes, we do, sir.
Okay, listen, I'm here because...
Are you the warden?
I'm here doing what I'm doing because the abuses and the treatment that we get, because the reason that we're in jails like this in Louisiana, these are our parish jails. We're here under contractual agreement through the U.S. government and sheriff's departments to house us here.
I see.
But the problem is that we're civil detainees. We're federal, and we're being housed and treated as convicted felons. The reason that we're being detained is because at one point or another we committed a crime after entering this country. And then once we entered here and we committed that crime, our parole status or our immigration status was revoked. And then we were detained. The problem is that our country, Cuba, I've been here since I was 2 years old, but I never became a citizen, does not accept me back in my country because there's no diplomatic relations between Cuba and the United States.
Right.
Therefore, they house us indefinitely and they treat us like we're convicted felons, and even worse at times. We don't get no privileges except for, you know, regular phone service. They charge us 50 cents a card. We buy a debit card,
right,
or $1.10 if we use the collect call only. We're not allowed to use coin-operated phones. They allow us 1 hour, 3 hours a week, once a week, of law library time. There's a lot of privileges that are taken from us. They treat us bad. The INS keeps us away from our families, hundreds and thousands of miles sometimes,
yep,
from our families, and they're not able to come visit us.
My question is to you, are one of the hostages nearby? Is the warden nearby?
The warden is not nearby, but one of the hostages.
May I speak with one of the hostages?
Excuse me?
May I speak with one of the hostages?
Yes, sir.
Yeah, sure. Hold on. Hold on a minute.
Okay, that's fine.
Hello?
Hello?
Yes?
Who are we speaking with?
Deputy Brandon Boudreau.
Deputy Boudreau?
Yes, sir.
Deputy Boudreau, listen, are you guys okay in there?
Well, it's just myself with them.
Okay, but I mean, are the other hostages okay at this point?
I believe so. I haven't actually seen them.
Okay, this is Gator and JJ at Cat Country 103 at Baton Rouge. We're live on the air. Apparently, the gentleman there with you, your captors, are making demands to be taken out. Do you have any idea whether that is going to be even a close possibility, or where do you think things stand at this point?
I have no idea, sir. Okay. I myself can't even get a straight answer from my people right now.
I see. You have made requests for food?
No, I'm not really hungry. I'm just sick right now.
You're just sick right now. All right. And as far as you know, the other hostages are okay, and you guys are so far being treated okay.
Yes, sir.
All right. Is there anything else you need at this time?
No, not offhand.
All right, then. If you could put me back on the phone with the guy that we were speaking to. Gator and JJ in the morning. It's 9:36. And we are live on the air with the hostage taker, the prison siege going on right now in St. Martinsville.
And you're listening to the Gator and JJ show in Baton Rouge, Cat Country 103, as they interview both the leaders of the prisoner rebellion at the Louisiana St. Martin Parish, as well as one of the hostages that is being held there, this in the fourth day of a rebellion at the jail. These Cuban detainees are being held indefinitely by the Immigration and Naturalization Service, the INS. We're joined by a number of people to talk about this, among them Cheryl Little from the Florida Immigrant Advocacy Center. Cheryl, you have dealt with Haitian refugees. That's how I knew you over the years, being held at Chrome Jail Detention Facility in Florida, as well as people from all over the world being held by the INS. What prospects do these prisoners have?
Well, I think the reason that, you know, we're facing this dilemma is that they feel they have no hope. And I think the way that these cases have been handled in recent months is it's been a recipe for disaster. A lot of our clients have been longer in INS custody than they were in jail for the underlying crimes they committed. The release procedure that was put in place a while ago after a 47-day hunger strike by parents of INS detainees, Cubans, at the edge of Chrome, that release procedure, frankly, has been extremely arbitrary and inconsistent. There's been no rhyme or reason as to who's been getting released. And when people are in jails like in Louisiana, they have even less an opportunity to make their case for release because they're removed from their support system, from their families, from their attorneys. And these facilities that they're being held in are designed for short-term detention, not for long-term detention. Folks in these jails, as you heard some of the detainees say, they don't have access to programs that regular inmates have access to. They can't work. They have nothing to do but think about, you know, the dilemma that they're in. They don't even have access to rehabilitative programs, and they have to prove rehabilitation in order to make their case for release.
I also understand that county governments find INS detainees particularly attractive because the INS pays the counties an average of $55 a day for each prisoner, which is more than the state pays for other people who are in jail. Now, in May of last year, the families of Cuban detainees at the INS Chrome Detention Facility outside of Miami staged a 47-day hunger strike to protest the indefinite detention of detainees. As a result, the INS commissioner ordered district directors to speed up deportation processes and consider releasing all those detainees that are not considered a risk to society. This is difficult because one of the things they have to do is prove that they've been rehabilitated, but they are denied rehabilitation programs. And so far, none of these changes have taken place. We're joined right now by two people who were deeply affected by the INS. Eladio Alfonso staged the hunger strike on behalf of his son, Mike Alfonso, who was detained at the INS facility at Chrome. Mike, can you talk about your stay in Chrome and why, how long you were held there and why?
I was held a total of 5 months for in immigration. I also was placed in a county jail away from the support system that Cheryl Little was talking about.
Mm-hmm. And why were you held for 5 months?
Well, I was held for only 5 months because of the hunger strike that my father and the other women undertook on their own behalf. That's the only reason why I was only there 5 months. Otherwise, it would have been a year, maybe more.
Eladio Alfonso, 47 yep. days of a hunger strike. That is a long time. That's more than a month and a half. Tell us why you undertook it.
Well, I kind of wish we've been into this problem with my son. We tried to catch the attention of the political people and the press, doing some kind of demonstration in the streets of Miami. But as far as we can go, we seen that we're doing something that doesn't appear to be any kind of opinion and the INS. So we decided to go into the hunger strike, trying to put this issue and the mind of the people and get their support. So that's why we start doing this at that time.
Now, I want to be clear, Mike, you had served a 5-year sentence in federal prison for a felony, but you were rearrested by the INS when you completed it. You arrived at Chrome on Christmas Eve last year. What were the conditions like?
Oh, I spent 2 days going between buildings because there was, you know, they have no organization in that place to start with. They had an influx of immigrants coming from Cuba at the time and Haiti in boats. So those were a priority, and therefore we got in the back, you know, in the back of the line each time a new group of people arrived. And it took us almost two and a half days to be processed, to be, you know, to for them to take our fingerprints and put us in the system. And it's really bad. No laundry. I mean, the conditions are really, really bad. They're not set up to take, to, you know, for what they're doing now is they're going into the jail business. And I don't know if you understand how the jail business is in the United States, but it's a big business, especially when the federal government is backing up and paying county jails and other people to take care of us, you know, of immigrants. It's a big money issue. I think it's what's all behind this, and the private organizations, the private companies that own the county jails and so forth, are pushing for these laws to get tougher. That's where the problem is. It's all about money in this country, and you know they're taking human beings and making them a meat market for their own pockets.
Jose Pertierra has remained on the line with us, the Cuban-American immigration attorney based in Washington, D.C. Jose, President Clinton knows well what these prison uprisings can mean politically. Can you talk about earlier prison uprising and the career of President Clinton?
Well, when President Clinton was governor of Arkansas, there was an uprising of Cuban detainees who had come over on the Mariel boat lift. And it lasted an awfully long time. And President Clinton, to this day, attributes his loss for re-election as governor of Arkansas to the prison uprising that occurred in Fort Chaffee, Arkansas. You know, the problem is that the Immigration Service steadfastly refuses to recognize the fact that these individuals have completed their sentences. We're not talking about individuals who are in the midst of completing sentences that have been given to them by judges. At the completion of their sentences, they should have been released into society because the judges themselves didn't think that these people were any longer a danger to society. Yet, because of their immigration status, they are kept in jail in life sentences. I believe that that's a violation of the spirit and the Constitution of the United States. And this is a country of laws. We should not hold people in jail for the rest of their lives for committing, in some cases, theft crimes. It's ridiculous. And it leads to these kinds of problems with no solutions, because if you keep people locked up for the rest of their lives for something like this, you're going to have riots of this kind. Unless they're willing to come to the table with Cuba and arrive at some sort of a negotiated solution so they can be normal diplomatic relations between the two countries, and we can have normal immigration accords as exists with most other countries in the world. Unless the U.S. government is willing to do that, then they should release the Cuban detainees, because it's inhumane to keep them in jail like this.
There are some remarkable figures. The INS detainees are the fastest-growing prison population, having tripled since the passage of the 1996 immigration laws. And there are now more armed INS agents than armed agents for the DEA, the FBI, and U.S. Customs combined. Cheryl, what is
that? Yeah, absolutely. According to INS, in October of 98, they had over 16,400 detainees in custody. They expect by the year 2001 that's going to increase to over 24,000. Roughly 60% of their population today are now being housed in these county jails because they don't have enough facility themselves to house these people. And they're housed in jails where their INS files don't follow them. They're being run by people who don't know anything about immigration and immigration cases. And very often, detainees are like ping pong balls. They're being transferred from county jail to county jail to county jail. Sometimes it takes us weeks to locate our clients. And I also want to point out that a number of federal courts have found that these laws that are holding detainees like the Cubans indefinitely after they've finished serving their sentences are unconstitutional.
Finally, Eladio Afonso, with your 47-day hunger strike outside the Chrome Detention Center where your son was being held, do you feel like you accomplished anything? And what do you feel as you watch this fourth day of a prison rebellion in Louisiana?
Well, I think I accomplished the freedom of my son. And some others have been released since the hunger strike ends. But INS promised us that they're going to take a fair review of all the cases for of the Cubans that have been detained for immigration for a long term at the end of the hunger strike. But they did this for the first 3 months. After that, they stopped making a review of the case, and they released a small amount of people. So I think that they know, INS know or knew what is going on with this detainees, most of them out of the state where they live, and they get the support from the family and the lawyer and all the rest of the people. So these people are desperate, and they knew that. They get notice of this from weeks before this happened, and they did nothing. They just sit down and wait for this to happen. I think INS have a lot of responsibility in what is going on in Louisiana.
Eladio Afonso, I want to thank you very much for being with us, as well as your son, Mike Alfonso.
May I interject?
Mike, I just have 10 seconds.
Okay.
Go ahead.
The reason, you know, there's two classes of Cubans that the INS qualifies. One is non-Mariel, and other is Mariel. Non-Mariel are people that have been here since the gentleman that's holding hostages, which has been here since 2 years old, and the people that have more due process are the people that came from Mariel. They should be held in one light. They should be, you know, qualified and released on the same issues. And they don't do that. Immigrants that came as little and became residents are treated differently, and those are the ones being held longer. The ones from Mariel are being released.
Mike Alfonso and Eladio Alfonso, thank you for being with us. We're going to turn now to another issue that has been occupying national attention here in this country, and it is the story of little Elian Gonzalez. Some might say he is also being held hostage. Others say that he, in a sense, is a freedom fighter. I heard John McCain, the Republican candidate for president, saying that if his father truly cared about him, he wouldn't want him to live in a communist tyranny, suggesting that his father was unfit if he wanted him to come back to Cuba. But since we have immigration lawyers on the phone with us, I wanted to ask you, Jose Pertierra, about the laws and where we stand now. Little Elian has been taken to Disney World. The mayor of New York, Giuliani, has invited him to the Millennium Celebration in New York. But he's been meeting with the INS, and the INS has been meeting with his father, Juan Gonzalez, in Cuba.
Well, yeah, it's kind of a strange situation to put a little six-year-old boy in. He certainly, I don't think by any stretch of the imagination, could be considered a freedom fighter. He's only a six-year-old boy, for the love of God. The immigration laws are very clear that in a case where the father resides abroad and is the custodial parent because of the death of the mother of the child, then the immigration service needs to abide by the wishes of the custodial parent. He is now living with basically a distant relative. It's a great uncle, the brother of the boy's grandfather. I don't think that the U.S. immigration laws contemplate that a distant relative, such as a great uncle, should have custody rights that would trump those of a custodial parent. The custody laws of the state of Florida and the custody laws in any civilized country really don't permit you to go behind the issue of custody and talk about the father losing his rights to custody because he lives in basically an impoverished country. Cuba is far poorer than the United States, and there is no Disneyland. In Cuba, there's probably very few Pokemon cards. But his father is in Cuba. His father has chosen to live in Cuba. It is up to the father to decide where this boy is going to live. Now, I know that Senator McCain would not like that little boy to live in Cuba, but unfortunately, little Elian is not Senator McCain's son, and it is not up to Senator McCain to decide where the boy should live. It
Jose
is up to the father to decide.
Jose Pertero, we have to break for stations to identify themselves. When we come back, we'll also be joined by Phyllis Benes, who's with the Institute for Policy Studies, who's just returned from a boat trip to Cuba and was there for the Elian Gonzalez demonstrations. You're listening to Pacific Radio's Democracy Now! We'll be back in a minute. You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman as we talk about the case of little six-year-old Elian Gonzalez, who's now in the United States. His mother died as she tried to come to the United States from Cuba in a boat along with her son Elian. He was found in a tire floating in the water by fishermen. Phyllis Benes joins us from Washington, D.C. She's just returned from Cuba, where she was in a witness to the demonstrations for Elian Gonzalez. Welcome, Phyllis.
Thanks very much, Amy.
Phyllis, you're with the Institute for Policy Studies. You were, interestingly enough, on a boat talking about Iraq sanctions on your way to Cuba?
Yeah, it was the Japanese peace boat, a longstanding project of the Japanese peace movement, who had asked me to sail with them on one segment of their round-the-world trip from, in this case, the Canary Islands to Cuba, doing a series of lectures on the United Nations, U.S.-UN relations, and Iraq. And when we landed in Cuba, we were there, we arrived on the 6th of December, which, of course, was just at the moment that the buildup of outrage around the case of Elian Gonzalez was just taking hold. And I was in Havana for the three major demonstrations that were held, the largest of which brought about 500,000 people, 500,000 people, which is 25% the population of the city of Havana, in a massive march. This one was, unlike the others, was not a rally, but a march past the U.S. interest section in Havana. The target of the protests was the U.S. government. There was some acknowledgement among many Cubans that the right-wing Cuban elements in Miami, the Cuban American National Foundation in particular, and their supporters in the Congress, had been responsible for the use of this child's tragic, really tragic predicament as a political mobilization tool. The sight of Ileana Ross-Layton, the congresswoman from South Florida, who draped the kid in a T-shirt of the foundation and plied him with toys and posed for photographers with him, I think struck a huge chord in the population in Cuba, so that participation in the demonstrations was massive. Certainly most of the demonstrations were organized through contingents of trade unions, of students, of teachers, that sort of thing. But there were a fairly large number of people participating just as individuals as well, in families. Lots of kids were part of the protests. Many children spoke, in fact, as well. And what was striking...
I hear that one of the kids, or the kids were saying, we want Elian Gonzalez to come home and bring the toys, too.
Right. Right. They wanted him to come home and bring the toys. In one conversation with his father, apparently, he was bragging to his father that now he has three bicycles, which, you know, a bicycle for a kid in Cuba is a pretty rare item. As Jose said, it's a very poor country. The toys are far more basic than the kinds of bicycles that he was getting. And his father said to him, but do you want to trade me for your three bicycles? You know, this notion of trying to woo the kid, to court the kid with toys and trips to Disney World is a pretty appalling state of affairs. By coincidence, the regularly scheduled meetings between the U.S. and Cuba that are held every 6 months to assess the progress of the 1994 immigration agreement between the U.S. and Cuba was scheduled for this week, and that went on Monday and Tuesday of this week between Ricardo Alarcón, the president of Cuba's National Assembly, and the former United Nations ambassador, who many Pacifica listeners will remember from his years at the UN. He was often on our airwaves. Those talks went forward, but of course the regular discussions that they were designed to take up were by far overshadowed by the crisis surrounding this child, because there's not only the question of the very basic rights of parents, that whenever there is the death of a parent in a tragic situation, the other parent has custody. That's not an issue that should be up for grabs in the U.S. courts. But additionally, the existing U.S. immigration agreement with Cuba says that anyone picked up at sea, and it's designed specifically to prevent people from leaving in these very weak and insufficient rafts and small boats in this treacherous 90-mile strait between the U.S. and Cuba. To prevent that, the agreement says that anyone picked up at sea by the Coast Guard is to be returned to Cuba. It doesn't say, unless they happen to be a 6-year-old boy who makes a perfect poster child for the Cuban American National Foundation. This boy, both by the U.S.-Cuba agreement and by any normal understanding of custody laws, belongs at home. And the Cuban response was one of tremendous outrage. There was a very personal take on this. I have no doubt that many people in Havana were getting a little tired of the daily demonstrations, because it virtually shut down the city every afternoon. But the sense of outrage and the sense of how angry people were was a very real one. I saw during the demonstrations, what was striking was that many parents who were there with their children — kids in Cuba tend to be a little on the wild side. When they're running around on the streets, they tend to run ahead of their parents, that sort of thing. But at the demonstrations, I saw a huge percentage of the parents holding very tight to their kids' hands. Many fathers had their kids riding on their shoulders. And I don't think it was because it was such a long march. I think it was because they were feeling very vulnerable, that any time some rich country, particularly the United States, with its tendency to ride roughshod over Cuba's rights in any environment possible, could take away their children solely on the basis of they would have more toys here in the United States. It was quite a frightening thing, I think, for Cuban parents to see.
Well, we will continue to follow the story. And Phyllis Bennis, I want to thank you for being with us as we move now into our last segment. Phyllis Bennis is a fellow or sister at the Institute for Policy Studies in Washington, D.C.
This call is coming from a correctional facility.
That's the sound
of a phone company making a tremendous amount of money. Prisons, in theory, were intended as places for rehabilitation and punishment, but more and more are being used as places for corporations to make a profit. In this case, making a fortune out of misfortune. With the U.S. prison population projected to reach 2 million by February, major phone companies such as AT&T and MCI offer states large commissions to charge excessively high rates for calls made to the families and friends of prisoners. We're joined now by Michael Deutsch and Steve Whitman. Michael Deutsch is a lawyer based in Chicago who's suing behalf of families in Illinois. Steve Whitman is an organizer for the Prison Phone Project, who works with families and friends of inmates to fight against these phone rates. Michael Deutsch, tell us about the suit.
Well, essentially the suit is charging a conspiracy between the state of Illinois and five major phone companies, including AT&T, MCI, and Ameritech, and two others. And basically it says that they negotiate an agreement to charge the highest possible rates to the families and loved ones of prisoners, and then the money that's generated, half of it is kicked back to the state. And basically what you have is the state conspiring with the phone companies to rip off the families of the prisoners, and they make it so the prisoners' families cannot use any other phone service but the designated phone service for that particular prison. So, for example, a family member theoretically could get an 800 number, which is very easy to do, and their incarcerated loved one could call them at much lower rates. The prison prohibits that. It prohibits all kinds of deals that you hear on the television about dialing a certain amount of numbers and getting 30 to 40% off your collect call rates. It prohibits debit calling. It prohibits using a phone card. It forces the family members to pay the highest possible rates, where in Illinois it's now up to $22 for a 30-minute call. Hmm. And in 1997, the state of Illinois made over $15 million in kickbacks as a result of these outrageous phone charges. And this is really happening in every state, in almost every county jail, and it's essentially a way to generate revenues off the backs of people who can least afford it, who are literally a captive market because they have no alternatives.
So, Steve Whitman of the Prison Phone Project, what are you doing about this?
Well, I think we've been involved in anti-prison work in any number of areas for quite a while, a collective that I work with, and recently, in the last couple of years, more and more we had been hearing people talk about how they would just, sort of the human side of it. I mean, Michael's just summarized, I think, the facts perfectly. But we were hearing the human side of it, and families were telling us how their lives were just being devastated by the phone calls. I mean, it is literally the case that families were having to choose between eating and paying for these phone calls. And when we started to look into it, we weren't at that point aware of just how high the rates were. But in Illinois, they'll do things like there's a $3 connect fee and then the extraordinarily high minute-to-minute fee. And what they'll do is the system will automatically cut you off after 15 minutes. So if you want to speak more than 15 minutes, then you have to call back and once again sustain a new connect fee of $3. And so, as I said, we were meeting people who more and more were choosing between eating and keeping their phone on. And so we thought we had to do something about it. And so we've been working with the families and loved ones of prisoners in Illinois to try to put public pressure on the state officials and the telephone companies to just stop this very exploitative practice.
Well, Michael Deutsch, the attorney bringing the lawsuit on behalf of families in Illinois, what do you say to the argument that the prison makes? I'm looking at an editorial in the New York Times, When Johnny Calls Home from Prison, and it says the New York State correctional system may get the biggest commission of all in its MCI contract, 60%. As far as we're concerned, says James Flatteau, a spokesperson for the state's correctional system, It's a means where inmates help to offset their cost of incarceration.
Well, first of all, inmates are not the ones that are paying these exorbitant rates. It's the families of inmates. It's the friends of inmates. It's the lawyers who are getting calls from inmates. And there's no theory in law that allows you to punish the family member of somebody in prison. That's one thing. Number two, in Illinois, and I suspect in New York, although it's said otherwise, the bulk of the money does not go to run the prisons or programs for prisoners. The bulk of the money goes right into the state treasury, and it can be used for anything it wants, police cars, video equipment, just running the state budget. So they don't use the money. It'd be one thing if they used the money for programs that promoted rehabilitation for inmates. And I know in New York they say a lot of the money goes to AIDS programs. But our investigation proves shows that very little of the money goes to help inmates. So you're ripping money off from family members, and then you're using it to run the state budget. And it's really consistent with this whole development of a prison industrial complex. Corporations making huge amount of money off of the construction and running of prisons. $40 billion generated in revenues. And people are vying for it. Phone companies are tripping over each other to get these contracts because they're very lucrative. They're charging these huge rates, and there's really no cost basis for it. If you charge $22 for a 30-minute call, it probably costs the phone company less than 5% of that for their operating expense.
Steve Whitman of the Prison Phone Project in Chicago, are there any successes for the organizing around the country?
Well, I think not yet in the ultimate sense. And although in one Midwestern state, I've forgotten which one it is, they were able to get the rates reduced. Which one?
Kentucky.
They were able to get the rates reduced. But I think what's happening is there's a national movement that's growing. And no matter which prison conference we go to, this issue of exorbitant rates for telephone bills is being discussed. People are organizing. People are mobilizing. Different strategies are being discussed. And people are working together within states and across state lines. So I think, in a sense, it's very energizing and spiriting that we are, that so many people see the injustice in this matter and are working together against it. You know, I think, if I may, there's one dimension of this which I think just can't be
very
lost.
Very quickly.
Can't be lost on us, and that's the racial dimension. And what's happening is more and more the prison population is becoming blacker and blacker. For example, in Illinois, a black person is 13 times more likely to go to prison than a white person. This is also just looking more and more like slavery. I mean, the families are being squeezed to pay their phone bills. The prisoners are being put in prison to give white guards jobs. And so it looks more and more like we're revisiting the whole notion of slavery.
Steve Whitman, if people want to get in touch with the Prison Phone Project, I hesitate to say, where can they call?
Yes. Well, they can call but not collect. At 773-235-0070 in Chicago, Illinois.
That's 773-235-0070. Steve Whitman, Prison Phone Project. Michael Deutsch, lawyer based in Chicago. Thank you very much for being with us. I want to let you know about a special project we're embarking on, a listener's sentry. We'd like you to call in to our phone line, Not Collect, and let us know what you think are the most important events, people, issues of the 20th century. You can call us at 212-209-2999, and we're going to be playing that full program of listeners' calls on December 30th. That's 212-209-2999. That does it for today's program. Democracy Now! Is produced by Maria Carrion and David Love. Special thanks to Errol Maitland, our technical director, and to Karen Palmer. I'm Amy Goodman from the studios of WBAI in New York. Thanks for listening to another edition of Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! And special thanks to engineer in Washington, Joe Gill.
How many years can a mountain exist before?
I'm John Wiener, contributing editor of The Nation magazine, and this is...